We're back at the Radio Cafe. This is Zaylee Pollan sitting in for Mary Charlotte. I'm here today with Father John Deere, an internationally known voice for peace and nonviolence. He's a longtime activist, lecturer, organizer, and the author of more than 30 books and hundreds of articles, including Persistent Peace, Jesus the Rebel, and his most recent book, The Nonviolent Life. From 2002 to 2004, John served as pastor of several parishes in northeastern New Mexico. He co-founded Pax Christi New Mexico and works on a nonviolent campaign to disarm Los Alamos in New Mexico of its nuclear weapons. Currently, John is in the middle of a 45-city tour, lecturing to tens of thousands of people in churches and schools and community centers across the country and the world. He, I think, continues to write a weekly column for the National Catholic Reporter at www.ncronline.org. And in 2008, he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Father John Deere will be speaking tonight, May 7th at 7 p.m., the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at 107 West Barcelona. Father John Deere, welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Zaylee.
That's quite an incredible bio. I know many people have heard you on the cafe before, but we just want to fill them in. And I want to ask, after reading The Nonviolent Life, so much of your writing and the articles has its foundation in a very nonviolent Jesus. Can you tell us about the Jesus whose lead you're following in this life of activism?
Sure. Well, thank you. And it's wonderful to be back here. I'm just a big student of Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi, and they just talk morning, noon, and night about nonviolence. And nobody else is talking about that, you know? And it's a clumsy word. It doesn't work. Love is a better word. Peace is good. But even those words are so co-opted. So I'm sticking with Gandhi and Dr. King and talking about nonviolence morning, noon, and night. Well, that means everything has to change. Everything has to be seen from a perspective of nonviolence. It's why I wrote this new book, The Nonviolent Life, and what I'll be talking about at the church, what I'm talking about all over the country, that everything we look at in life has to be seen from this Gandhian, Kingian perspective, which means we're working for a world without war or poverty or nuclear weapons. We have to be nonviolent in our own lives, creating a nonviolent Santa Fe and so forth. But this means our theology, our spirituality, and every understanding of organized religion has to be nonviolent. That was the point of religion. And certainly, I argue, it's the hallmark of Christianity. Gandhi had this incredible statement: Jesus is the most active person of nonviolence in the history of the world. That, to me, is amazing, coming from the great Hindu. And then poor Gandhi goes on to say about poor Jesus, "And the only people on the whole planet who don't know that Jesus is nonviolent are Christians," you know, which is pathetic and true. And it's the one neglected thing. So I've come to the conclusion, I've written many books about it and talk about it, that Jesus is the embodiment of nonviolence, if Gandhi is right. And if that's true, oh my gosh, the church has to be a community of nonviolence, followers of the nonviolent Jesus. So all his teachings are, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount, which Gandhi read every day: blessed are the peacemakers, offer no violent resistance to one who does evil, love your enemies. These are incredible teachings of nonviolence. And then you see, this is goofy, but Jesus is like Gandhi or Dr. King or Dorothy Day. He organizes a nonviolent movement and goes on a campaign to Jerusalem, where he does civil disobedience in the temple and confronts injustice. And if you're doing that in the outskirts of a horrible empire, they're going to arrest you and torture and kill you. And that's the story. And he's saying, if you want to follow me, you have to join this campaign of nonviolence to work for a disarmed world. It's fantastic. And I think, you know, with all the terrible problems in all the churches, the more I study this Gandhian vision of Jesus, the more exciting and radical and revolutionary Jesus is, and more political. And I, therefore, and this is going to push everybody's buttons, but I don't think you can be a Christian and have a gun. support them, any military, not just the U.S., any military. You can't send your kids off to war. You can't support war. You can't work to build nuclear weapons. And you have to be joining the campaign to end war and poverty. Isn't that exciting, Zaylee?
You know, I after reading your book, I would certainly stand behind you. I know that this viewpoint has gotten you in trouble, even specifically here in New Mexico. Archbishop Michael Sheehan removed your priestly faculties because he objected to the prayer vigils for peace that you were having at Los Alamos Laboratory, and you've been a very active anti-nuclear activist. So why don't more people follow this? Why is there such a dissection? And I see it. It comes in cycles, and it seems that now this emergence of a Christian right is becoming more violent, and, yeah. and you hear hate speech instead yeah. of peace and love speech. What is happening?
I'm almost speechless because what you put the predicament very well. You know, on the one hand, you'd think this is the simplest thing, what I'm talking about. Let's all be peaceful, loving, and nonviolent. And it's the hardest thing, and it's the most neglected thing, and it's the one thing nobody's talking about because we're talking about war, and there's a lot of money to be made by it. And the churches are afraid if they come out against war, which they've never really done for the last 1,700 years. We rejected the Sermon on the Mount, came up with the just war theory. If we did that, we'd lose money, and that's certainly the issue here in New Mexico. So I've found, unfortunately, they're not going to give you the Nobel Peace Prize if you start advocating nonviolence. I mean, Thich Nhat Hanh, Daniel Berrigan, and Dorothy Day, Gandhi, all these great people never got awarded it. War makers get it. No, you get in trouble. And Jesus was killed, and Gandhi and King were brutally killed. This isn't going to go over well. This is what I say on my bad days. On good days, I hope, you know, that more and more of us are going to wake up. That's why I'm going around talking and organizing, because change only happens from bottom-up grassroots movement building. Mm-hmm. Isn't that interesting? The abolitionists, the suffragists, the civil rights movement, and the thousands of movements happening in the world right now. It's always bottom-up grassroots movement. And it's the same with the church. So the far right, the military establishment, which has infinite trillion dollars, can buy off all the churches. And they've done that over the last 50 years. We've seen that. It's unprecedented. And they're telling us how to be church. And we go right along with it, you know, instead of letting the Sermon on the Mount instruct us how to be church. That should be the hallmark of the measure of our Christianity. So we have to reorganize, reclaim the basis of Christianity and nonviolence, and we have to keep building movements to end war and poverty and nuclear weapons, and to work that all the churches are peace churches. That should be an oxymoron, but unfortunately, that's the situation. And it's understandable. For 1,700 years, the church has sort of rejected nonviolence and espoused the just war theory, which is never mentioned in the four Gospels, which has nothing to do with the nonviolent Jesus. But the good news is, Zaylee, that people are waking up around the world. And maybe that's why this type of repression is, we're seeing it a little bit more. I mean, nobody's been talking about nonviolence as much as we have in the last few decades. And the recent popes have said we're going to get rid of the just war theory. Well, that only leaves the Sermon on the Mount, the nonviolence of Jesus. So this is hopeful, and that's why I encourage everyone to continue to pursue the gospel vision of nonviolence and in nonviolence of whatever religion they're at, and to keep joining the grassroots movement.
And I was going to say, I mean, 30 books on nonviolent. Are people hearing your message as you travel around? Are you seeing a sea change or even little tiny changes?
Well, you know, the movement for peace, on the one hand, has been really up and down. Certainly, I've been full-time doing this for 35 years. So, you know, I go back to the early 80s when everybody was so scared about Reagan and nuclear weapons, to even 10 years ago, the organizing against the war in Iraq. But it's really died down these last 5 or 6 years as people put their energies into the Obama election, and then people were so disappointed with the outcome of that. You know, but as I've traveled the country, I just came back this weekend from 8 days speaking all over Alaska. And you know, what's new is that in every city, there are pockets of peace and justice people. And I know that from Santa Fe to Juneau to, I was in Chattanooga, Tennessee 2 weeks ago, to a packed church, and I'm all over the country, there are people working for peace and justice all over the country. That certainly wasn't the way it was 50 years ago. My friends who are Martin Luther King's friends say, it's amazing what's happening in the grassroots. Now, we need to all connect with one another, know that we're part of a national movement, and begin to rebuild the movement. And connect the dots. By that I mean what's happening in the environment is connected to poverty, is connected to drones and war, to Los Alamos, where all the money is going. All of it's one, and we often forget that. So I feel hopeful, and we have to be hopeful because we all have to pitch in and join the movement and be part of it. So that's good.
Let's talk a little bit about the nonviolent life. You suggest three dimensions of nonviolence. Can you talk about those three dimensions, go into them a little bit?
Well, Zaley, I've been talking about nonviolence for 35 years, and like, how do you explain it to people? I mean, and I've read so much of Gandhi, and it goes over my head and all. So I've written this book to put it in as simple as way as possible, first of all, for myself. And I hope people will get it, and that's what we'll be talking about at the church in Santa Fe tonight. So here's my pitch, as you said, that nonviolence requires three simultaneous attributes. The catch is you have to do all three, and we're good at one or two of them. But few people reach the heights of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and Dorothy Day. So this would be a holistic vision of nonviolence. So here goes. Number one, you got to be really nonviolent to yourself. Doesn't that sound nice? It's really hard.
It's hard. And you mentioned even peace activists have a hard time.
Don't get me going. Okay, but just to mention the three, nonviolence to yourself, number one. At the same time, number two, to try to practice meticulous interpersonal nonviolence. So nonviolence toward every human being on the planet and all creatures and all of creation. But at the same time, also number three, to have one foot in the global grassroots movement of nonviolence. So I hope people understood what I'm saying, because in my experience, having talked to so many people around the country, there's this whole group of us that, especially church people, were really nice. And they say, oh, I'm really working on being peaceful in my life and really nice and good. And when I'm finally perfectly there, then I'll get involved in the movements of peace and justice. And I say, that's not nonviolence. It's certainly not Christianity. If you're not working to end war and poverty, then your silence is complicit in structured evil. On the other hand, the flip side of us are all these hardcore activists like me. You know, we're really involved in the movement, but we're full of violence and our personal lives were very violent. And that doesn't work either. That's not the Gandhian way, not to mention Jesus or Buddha and all the world's religions. So to practice all three, really nonviolent to yourself, making peace with yourself, really nonviolent toward others, making peace with all others, and being part of the grassroots movement for a new world of peace.
As you write in the book, I mean, it takes practice all the time. And as I mentioned, you had really spoken about, yes, those in the peace and justice movement really reconciling with their own demons before moving forth. But we are not perfect individuals as we set out on this path, are we?
No.
And so it all has to be a process.
Right. That's beautifully put. It's a process. It's a journey. And that's a nice way to put it. That's a nonviolent way to put it. You know, people who care, well, first of all, we're all violent. I think we're all addicted to violence, and we're all victims of this culture and world of violence. Mm-hmm. And the question is, how deep have we been wounded by violence? And when did we begin turning from the way of violence to the way of nonviolence and peace? Those are great questions. You know, we don't want to be wounded wounders, but wounded healers. And so that means really being conscious of what's going on inside of us and how can we lessen the violence inside of us. These are maybe two esoteric terms, but to cultivate interior nonviolence, well, that requires meditation, contemplation, sitting with ourselves. I love Thich Nhat Hanh's beautiful phrase, just to look deeply within. Why did I do that? I found that quote that I mentioned at the front of the book from Gandhi. Nonviolence is the highest form of conscious living. That's a profound thing. The highest level of consciousness is nonviolence. I think he's right. So you're really working on inner nonviolence. And then you look at relationships, and it's two things. One, how do you respond to people who threaten you or push all your buttons and you're difficult and, you know, and you want to retaliate, but you don't want to do that. And so to think through it and to try to be creatively nonviolent. And on the other hand, who are you hurting? You know, and how can we stop hurting others? And what about our relationship with animals and creatures and creation now in a world of climate change? And third, being part of the movement. If people are part of any way in the movement, I thank them. But if they're not, I urge people to pick a cause and get involved. That's what I always say. I quote Oscar Romero, nobody can do everything, but everybody can do something. Isn't that lovely?
Absolutely.
And just to pick one or two, three things and pitch in, whether for the environment or poverty here in New Mexico and kids, or working to end drones, or getting rid of nuclear weapons at Los Alamos. This is just insanity. We don't need them anymore. And they're not helping, and it's not moral, by the way. So, and doing well, doing what you can. And if we can balance all three, then we're on this journey together of working and living toward a new nonviolent world.
I'm speaking with Father John Deere. He'll be speaking tonight at the Unitarian Universalist Congregation at 107 Barcelona. You write also about fear. I mean, this idea of nonviolence in the face of violence. You have this quote, "If we live in fear, we will inevitably resort to violence to defend ourselves." And that really felt to me kind of the state of affairs that we're in right now. This cultivation of fear, so we're all in reaction mode, wanting to protect ourselves, our family, our country, our stuff. Talk about fear.
Wow. Well, you know, I was just in South Africa and went to where Gandhi lived for 20 years. I've just been studying him forever. Actually, to the place where he started all of this in 1903, you know, he professed 16 vows. And one of them, a vow of nonviolence, which I then did in 1982. But one of them was a vow of fearlessness. Gandhi said, you can't practice nonviolence if you're afraid. Case closed, he said. So you have to cultivate fearlessness, right? And then you look to the Christian tradition. You look at the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the four Gospels. What's the thing Jesus says more than anything else? Well, he's trying to form a community of nonviolence. He's training people to be nonviolent on the outskirts of this horrible empire, which is going to come in and kill everybody, which they eventually do. In the year 70, Jerusalem is destroyed. And he's saying, these guys are terrified because he's saying, love your enemies, be peacemakers. And by the way, we're going to Jerusalem and they're going to kill me. And he says, do not be afraid, do not be afraid, do not be afraid. So that's the teaching. And it's in Buddhism and Hinduism and so forth. Well, how do we do that? I find three things. I would say prayer, friends or a community or a peace group, and action. By that, I mean, I mentioned already, meditation, some kind of contemplative practice where you sit alone in silence with God or the universe or the spirit of peace or Jesus, wherever you are in your spiritual tradition, and cultivate peace and be with peace. And for me, as a Christian, I'm with the God who we believe is a personal God who loves everyone infinitely. Well, it's nice to be with someone who loves you. And the more you're with someone who loves you unconditionally, which was the point of Christianity, we've forgotten that. Like, there's the scandal of Christianity actually is that God is nonviolent. We don't want a nonviolent God. We much prefer a God who blesses our wars. But if we can imagine the nonviolence of God and let God love us, then we're less afraid. And you end up like Martin Luther King at the Lorraine Motel and say, you know, you can harass me, you can jail me, you can even kill me, but we're all headed toward the beloved community. Friends, a peace group, really help to have a group that you can talk about your fears with and then take action. Because if you're not with a group, you just end up watching the bombs fall on CNN or some catastrophe happening, and you're too afraid or despairing or helpless to do anything, and that's not helpful. And that leads to the third thing, that I find that taking another step forward on the road to peace helps lessen my fear. In other words, you have to, we're talking about dealing with our fears and not living in fear. I do a lot of journaling and inner reflection and retreats and saying, what am I afraid of now? You know, we're afraid of death. Were you afraid of your loss of reputation or people being mad at you or losing your job because you're against war and nuclear weapons? And then you find out, well, life is short, and I'm going to join this peace action, and then the fear goes away. This is a Latin American thing. You know, North Americans, we think that we can think our way into a new way of being or living or acting, but down there they say you have to act your way into a new way of thinking and being and living.
I just want to add that you have been arrested more than 75 times
for
civil disobedient actions.
Thank you very much.
So speaking of fear and facing those fears, that is fairly an awesome responsibility to take on. You are a father. You may assume people will treat you kindly, but they didn't do that with Father Romero, did they?
No. And it's hard. The last time I was arrested at Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, the headquarters of the drones. And we walked onto the base, and one of the young soldiers went crazy and screamed and yelled at us with a machine gun. Now, he had orders to shoot any trespassers. So later, the chief of police in Las Vegas told us we're lucky. But then we got into the Las Vegas City Jail, which was five stories below one of the casinos. And we're thrown in there with 500 people arrested that day. And the prison guards, run by a woman, were so scary. They were beating people up in front of my eyes. I mean, you know, and they don't know who I am or who any of us are. So you have to deal with your fears. I'm not saying everybody needs to get arrested, but I do say everybody needs to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, you can march, you can organize, you can contribute to the movement. And it's not just emails, and it's we all need to step up to the plate and do something. Maybe people just on the front lines of these movements can do civil disobedience, but everybody's got to be part of the movement. And living in fear is not fun anyway, and it's not a good way to live life. And you don't want to be in I write about too. You don't want to live in anger. That doesn't work as an activist. We want to live in peace and love, and we want to move toward the welcoming of a whole new world.
I recently interviewed Susan Steingraber, who is an environmentalist. She writes about the toxic world, and she says for parents, it's really embracing that. And it's saying, I am doing my part to change the world, and that's where you reach your strength, and that's also where you let your children be children, and you say, I'm doing this work. Don't you worry. We're working to make this a better world.
Right, and that's a good motivation. We're doing all of this for our children and the next generation and the future generations, and it doesn't look good. I mean, our leaders are not going to work for a nonviolent world. That's why all of us. But it's so liberating, too. If we're just doing one or two or three things a week, whatever we can, then we're all doing our part. My friend Mairead McGuire, who won the Nobel Prize from Northern Ireland, she says, we just have to do our wee bit for peace and justice. That's very liberating, nonviolent approach. We don't have to carry the weight of the world on our shoulders. We're sharing it together, and we're moving forward, rebuilding the movement. That's the point.
You also write about practicing sorrow and joy on a daily basis. Talk to us about the need to grieve. This really caught my attention.
Well, that's been something I've been learning. You know, after I wrote this book on Gandhi, I realized he read from the Sermon on the Mount every morning and every evening for the last 43 years of his life. And he's not even a Christian. He's saying it's the greatest writings of nonviolence. So I went back and I've been studying it and teaching it. As I write in my book here, The Nonviolent Life, Gandhi's saying Jesus is like a hands-on handbook. It's a catechism. It's how to be a human being in a world of war. And that's why Gandhi reads it every day. So all the instructions are there. Here's how to respond to people doing violence. Here's the way toward a new world of peace. Love your enemies. And he even instructs the emotional life. You know, and he has a long teaching, don't cultivate anger and don't be afraid. Well, then if those are not the emotions to practice, he's trying to train people to be nonviolent activists. This is Jesus. And let's say he's as smart as we are. I'm just proposing that. Well, then what do we do? I mean, that's fear and anger are our best things, especially if you care about the world. We're all angry and we're all afraid. Well, that's not going to sustain you. No, he says, cultivate grief and cultivate joy. Well, very few peace and justice people do that. Grief, because our sisters and brothers around the world are dying. And we're killing them, from Iraq to the drone strikes in Afghanistan to sisters and brothers dying of hunger and poverty to what we're doing to creation. I mean, grief has to be a daily practice for the rest of us now because it's way beyond New Mexico or the United States. All our sisters and brothers, all 7.2 billion people are suffering. But there's also joy. This is different than happiness. It's an inner I don't even know how to define joy, of a contentment and peace, and also a meaning for life in the Viktor Frankl sense. You know, that we have been part of the side of history to changing the world. You know, we're on the side of resurrection, the side of Dr. King and Gandhi. This gives you an inner joy. So in South Africa, you know, I spent a day with Archbishop Tutu just a few months ago. He got right into that. I might as well tell you this if we have a second. The first thing he says to me in Cape Town is, when he sees me coming through the door, he grabbed me and goes, John, we have to be working for justice and peace till the day we die. Now, he's 82. He's in ill health. He's under constant death threat. I was impressed. But being a wise guy, and he knows me, I said, oh, come on, Archbishop. How do you do that? And he leaned forward and he whispered to me, looking me in the eye, "I cry a lot."
Mm.
I mean, that's Archbishop Tutu. He said to me, "I have cried every day since I was a boy." I mean, this is a profoundly sensitive person, one of the world's greatest, history's greatest people. And that makes sense to me. He's grieving over the black South Africans suffering under apartheid, but the whole world. And then he said, "And I also laugh a lot. I laugh every single day. I cry and I laugh and I go forward working for justice and peace." And I thought, that's what I want. I don't want to be raging, angry activists all my life or living in fear. Tutu's not, and he's changing the world. All of us can inspire to that practice of grief and joy to cultivate a holistic way of peace and nonviolence. Does that make sense, Ailey?
Absolutely. I'm wondering, have you attained that, or are you integrating that into your life?
Didn't you say it's a process and a journey?
Absolutely.
There's no attainment. For me, that's the trap of the worst of the old Catholic Church, to be perfect. That got us into a lot of problems. You know, that's why the AA model is so helpful. You know, we're addicted to violence and we're on a journey of becoming sober people of nonviolence. We'll always be violent, but we're always going to practice the sobriety of nonviolence and turn to our higher power. And we're on a journey. It's a daily thing of the inner and the relationships and being part of the movement. And it's a balancing act. And, you know, you kind of go up and down. And I certainly go up and down and then learning, constantly learning. And if you're going to be really involved, I feel like I'm really involved in the world. Wow, people are going to be mad at you. And good people, church people, people who care, peace and justice people, for every kind, and you make mistakes too. So now you get to practice nonviolence. And, you know, this is all in training for, you think you've kind of reached it, and you discover you haven't even begun. So it's beautiful, and it's hard, and it's hopeful, and it's a journey. And I like that it's a process, and we're on this walk together toward a new future of peace and being healed ourselves and healing one another and trying to stop climate change. Or if everything is going to fall, to help it fall as nonviolently as possible, as fewer people could suffer. This is what I think, and we're trying to model it as we seek it.
And when we talk about the process, there is this unlearning of violence. I mean, violence is everywhere. So you constantly have to deflect the messages that are coming to you, coming to our children, coming in the newspaper, coming in media. So this is work on a daily basis. Yeah. You have another quote. You have amazing quotes by Martin Luther King and Gandhi throughout your book, but that the choice is no longer violence or nonviolence. It's nonviolence or non-existence.
Gandhi said that the last week he was alive, and King said that the night before he was killed.
Hmm.
I don't know that King got that from Gandhi, but he must have, because he was reading Gandhi all the time, too. So I think that sums up the situation we're in right now. You see it in the newspapers. It's not violence or nonviolence. Everybody has to become nonviolent, or we will destroy ourselves. I mean, that's what catastrophic climate change is pointing to. Toward the use of nuclear weapons. We have more nuclear weapons now than ever before. You could argue we're as dangerous as we've ever been in history, except for maybe 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Or maybe we're even in that moment permanently now. So everything has to change, and everyone's got to be involved at doing the inner work and joining a peace and justice group and helping rebuild the movement.
I would like to read the Birmingham Pledge, which you have in your book. Can you describe to us what that is? Because then I'll go through the 10 steps.
Well, when Martin Luther King went into Birmingham in 1963, which changed the country and the world, that really was the heart of the civil rights movement. They didn't know it was going to work. But all the other movements were failing, especially Albany, Georgia. So they picked the worst, hardest place with the toughest, meanest white leader, Bull Connor, went into Birmingham, most segregated city in the United States, on a par, if not worse, than apartheid in South Africa. And they did daily demonstration. King was arrested. He wrote the famous letter from Birmingham jail. And then the movement leaders called out all the high school kids. And then the elementary school kids, little 7, 8, 9-year-olds, they're marching through Birmingham. Bull Connor's yelling, screaming at them, letting the police dogs loose, calling the fire department to unleash the fire hose on them. And then there's this one day, I forget the actual date, it's like May 6, 1963. Here's thousands of kids chanting the song Freedom, Oh Freedom. Mm-hmm. And here's 100 white firemen with the hoses. O'Connor's in the middle yelling, and the chief of the fire department started to cry and said, I didn't train to turn fire hoses on kids. And not one of them obeyed Bull Connor. And the kids walked through them, and that's when segregation fell. Well, you go, well, that's incredible nonviolence. No, they trained for it. They trained hard. Every kid had training in nonviolence, everyone in the civil rights movement, and that's why everyone today has to be trained in nonviolence. You should all be making a workshop, study it, and so forth. Now, I know this personally because I'm friends with Martin Luther King's friends. I used to be the director of the FOR, Fellowship of Reconciliation, and King was a big part of it. My friend was Reverend Jim Lawson, who brought Dr. King to Memphis. He was my boss at FOR, but I knew him in jail for 30 years. He called me. He was teaching at Harvard, and he said, John, can you give me any advice on any, like, short thing on nonviolence, which is ridiculous because he's like Mahatma Gandhi, because I need it for tomorrow for my class. And I said, oh, well, you know that pledge, the Birmingham pledge? You remember that, Jim? He goes, I wrote it. And he said, so he's telling me the story about it. They made everyone agree to these 10 conditions. Now, every peacemaker today should agree to them for any march, but they're kind of a way of life if you want to read them to us. Like, you know, how are you going to practice a nonviolent life? That's why I put it in the book, because they're so concrete. And they open the way for those kids to change the country.
Number one, meditate daily on the teachings and life of Jesus. Number two, remember always that the nonviolent movement seeks justice and reconciliation, not victory. Three, walk and talk in the manner of love, for God is love. Four, pray daily to be used by God in order that all men and women might be free. Five, sacrifice personal wishes in order that all men and women be free. Six, observe with both friend and foe the ordinary rules of courtesy. Seven, seek to perform regular service for others and for the world. 8, refrain from the violence of fist, tongue, or heart. 9, strive to be in good spiritual and bodily health. And 10, follow the directions of the movement.
Wonderful.
Probably should have had you read that, but I...
No, it was great. Thank you, Zaylee.
And you will also be doing training. Can you talk a little bit about the Campaign for Nonviolence quickly?
Right. So my friends and I at campaignnonviolence.org are organizing hundreds of movements around the country this fall. It's very exciting. And it's even going to take place in Santa Fe on October 1st. And what we're asking for is people locally to march from a place of peace, like a park or a church, to a place representing the government, like a federal building, under the theme of being against war and or poverty and or the environment. So people can check out campaignnonviolence.org. We have 35 state coordinators at the moment, and it's very exciting. And I hope people will be part of it here in Santa Fe and all our efforts for nonviolence.
And I assume you'll be speaking about that tonight. Father John Deere will be speaking at 7 p.m., the Unitarian Universalist Congregation, that's at 107 West Barcelona. Thank you so much for joining us here in the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me, Zaylee. All the best.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Zaylee, sitting in for Mary Charlotte.